CliffCentral.com. And then we've got Canton Pillay here today as well, which is very exciting. Canton, it's nice to see you.
I wish that the coffee had actually been enough to wake me up, guys. As you know, I was sort of coding until the small hours of this morning.
Were you?
My brain is fried.
Shame, man. I'm sorry. Are you feeling that kind of semi-sort of awake, semi-conscious, struggling to keep your eyes open feeling, or is it more of a...
Yeah, it's this. Is this still real life? Is this just fantasy kind of thing?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in other words...
Now I have the song in my head.
in other words, we're going to get a very interesting burning platform today. All right, so Canton, first of all, thanks for joining us. It's always nice to talk about news with you because you have an interesting take on things and you pay attention to what's going on in the world. And occasionally, most of us would like to just get to work and be asked a question about current affairs and be able to deliver someone else's opinion because, hell, it's much too hard to think of your own. So we may borrow. Any of us who are listening this morning may borrow from you liberally and use your own opinions as ours.
That sounds fair.
Is that okay? All right. There's so much to talk about. Can we start with, I mentioned this briefly, the Public Enterprises Committee that have called in Parliament for former ministers Malusi Gigaba and Lynn Brown to explain their roles in governance failures at Eskom. Now, it strikes me as really odd and quite worrying that these two ministers are now gone. I don't know if they're leading lives as private citizens. What they do every day, do they wake up late? Do they take the kids to school?
Gigaba, we know
Malusi's
what he does.
we know what Gigaba's doing. He's busy taking pictures.
He takes matters in his own hand.
All right,
sorry.
And for all we know,
that
you
started
know,
too soon.
For all we know, Lynn is sending pictures out as well. We don't know. We don't know what Lynn's doing. We don't know what she was doing when she was minister.
That is a scary thought, and I'm not going there.
I don't know if it's any more scary than Malusi, but all right, this Public Enterprises Committee, why is it taking so long for us to hear from these people? And honestly, and I don't mean to be controversial or to try and speculate wildly about anything, but surely some of these people are criminally negligent. They've wasted vast amounts of taxpayers' money. They've denied and denied and denied to the point where we didn't know who to believe. And now we've got evidence that they were all complicit in this stuff. When does the accountability kick in? Like, when do we actually get to see them in court? Does it ever happen?
We get to see them in court when we actually have a head of the National Prosecuting Authority. It starts there. And until such time as that kicks into place, we're unlikely to see any of these charges actually being filed. The more interesting thing for me, guys, is this portfolio committee mm-hmm. is the very same portfolio committee that has been in place for the past 4 years.
So right? They're also...
Yes. So why were they silent up until now? Why were these guys not held accountable? So everything that we are seeing so far is a pretty clear indication that they're looking for a scapegoat. And it turns out that Malusi and Lynn Brown are... sacrificial lambs. No, they're not lambs.
Sacrificial old...
sacrificial mutton.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but did you guys have a look at this, at the report?
I'm afraid not. I hoped you did.
Yeah, guys, I skimmed through it, and they were so utterly scathing in terms of the stuff that they had to say about both Gigaba and... Lynn Brown, just in terms of their dereliction of duty, bypassing corporate governance, appointing people to the board who were clearly unqualified, and in so doing, fingering almost every person that...
Please don't use Lynn Brown and fingering in a sentence.
I can't deal with it. I need those drugs. But really, seriously scathing of these guys. And effectively what they've done now is they've pretty much passed the buck. Because as far as I'm concerned, if they've got that much clear-cut evidence, surely what should be happening at this point is within the scope of Parliament itself, there should be fundamental legislative changes that kick in that actually impose oversight upon these entities that is not waiting on the discretion of the President. Because fundamentally all of this stuff came about because the president had the ability to ride roughshod over parliament.
In other words, we need to figure out this balance of power again and perhaps change the way that it's constituted, because if there's a person at the top in the executive who doesn't really mind other people being in dereliction of duty or actually instigates that dereliction by imposing their will upon the legislature or upon the rest of the executive, there should be a mechanism to correct that.
Well, there would be in a normal society, but of course we've got this crazy situation because of the way in which our parliament is structured, where they are there on an ANC slate, and so ultimately they are accountable. Well, they were accountable to Zuma, which is why they actually played along with the entire process. And unfortunately, this is now the opportunity where essentially all of the MPs who are currently sitting on the ANC slate, they're still fundamentally Jacob Zuma appointees.
Yeah, of course.
All of them. Now,
he constituted that list along with the top six.
Absolutely. So now they actually have an opportunity, if they were actually thinking straight, to actually put in place legislation that would in some way curtail the ability of Cyril to do the same thing should Cyril suddenly go rogue at some point. Because let's be very clear, most of the people who are currently on the Jacob Zuma slate, they're not going to be in Parliament come next elections. They're going to be off that slate. So there's going to be a swing now in terms of Cyril's slate. And, you know, guys, there's an opportunity. Do the right thing. No, that's not going to happen, is it?
Well, you mentioned, and I think it's quite a valid point, that this is the same committee that's been sitting for 4 years. And they oversaw the complete destruction of SAA, the hollowing out of Eskom, Transnet. These are all the public enterprises we're talking about. The public enterprises committee should all be fired.
Absolutely.
Those people should lose their seat in Parliament, first of all on this committee, and second of all as MPs.
Yes.
So it's probably just as well they'll be off the slate.
Yes, but that's not to say that the people who come on board are not actually going to follow instructions that come from the top six as well. The top six right now are probably already planning their slates in terms of the next election. So you're going to see a division in terms of who actually gets into the National Assembly. That's pretty much based on the proportional representation that each of the top six kind of enjoyed. Unless, of course, we actually have an NPA director who gets appointed before the elections next year, in which case some of the top six might pretty much end up in jail. In fact, all of the top six might pretty much end up in jail.
That would be interesting.
That would be a good thing.
Imagine if that...
Kenton, though, I mean, last year, almost exactly a year ago, when we were watching for the first time, I think the country got to see what happens in the annals of the ANC.
And it was not a pretty sight.
When they have their elective conferences, what we also saw is we saw that the NEC is made up of more than just that top six. There's 150 whatever odd people who are pretty much the same people that are, and those people.
Well, Gigaba's still there.
And those are the people that become the MPs, though, you know. So that 150 people who are the ANC NEC are the first people that come in as MPs, right? And they're all the same.
Well, they get distributed. It's not just in the National Assembly. They end up as premiers.
Yes, of
they
course.
Deployed.
Yes,
deployed.
Of course.
Yes.
But the point being that I'm not sure if they are necessarily Zuma appointees or delegates. This is who the ANC wants.
Most of them can't believe.
That's quite right. The people who are currently on the NEC is not the same crowd that was constituted at the previous elections. That's absolutely right.
But most of these people can't believe how lucky they are that they've got any kind of gainful employment in the first place, so they're not going to rock the boat.
Well, it's,
most of them will just go the way that the president wants them to go.
Gainful employment. They draw salaries.
Okay, not gainful, but
really good salaries.
Yeah, they do. Gainful to them.
Yes, absolutely correct. Gainful to them. But I suppose going back to the whole question of what happens in terms of accountability, where do you actually start in terms of... Because this trough is so absolutely wide, and it's now running dry, and clearly all of these people who are sitting out there all need to be accountable in some way. There was an interesting conversation that happened on the Renegade Report with Wayne Duvenage, where he was suggesting that, you know, really what we need is something like the equivalent of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where we need a corruption commission, where you come forward, you say, I was corrupt, you declare, and you say, and give them amnesty on the basis that they pay back stuff, and then retire from public office and never show face again.
And hopefully, like the TRC, they'll find one black woman to hang like they did with Winnie Mandela.
Well, wouldn't it be nice though? I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you knew you didn't have to go to jail, but you could cleanse your soul before you died in...
They don't have to go to jail anyway.
Shame and squalor.
Here we sit, nobody going to jail
of
anyway.
Of course, but...
And they don't have to even unburden their souls.
Forgive me, I'm trying to be utopian here. I'm trying to imagine a world that that people would actually be accountable for their actions. All right, so Jacob Zuma, because we're talking about him, he says he resigned to save the ANC. This is despite Nwankwo Ramatlodi yesterday saying that Jacob Zuma divided the ANC. And I'm sure there are many other people who would...
Well, they're both right, surely.
Okay, explain that to me.
Well, Zuma didn't have a choice at that point because he could... it wasn't his opportunity to do a cope, let's put it that way. You know, the opportunity to do a cope came for Terry Lakota at the point at which Mbeki was...
ousted.
Was ousted, and he resigned at that point from the ANC and then set up COPE shortly afterwards before the next election. Jacob Zuma, right now, he still has too much skin in the game in terms of the power structures of the ANC. Mm-hmm. So he's not going to be a 20% minority that's going to pull out from the ANC. He still has a substantial amount of control within that organization. And his ability to continually exert influence on the numbers, we mustn't underestimate that. I've been, if search my timeline, you know, going back more than 10 years, I keep saying, underestimate Jacob Zuma at your peril. This guy is flippin' smart. He knows exactly what he's doing. And everything that he's doing right now in terms of his politicking in KZN is to ensure that he's actually maintaining his power base. He's telling his entire support base in KZN, guys, I'm still here. And you mess with me, there's going to be trouble.
Well, of course, the stakes are very high for him, because if anyone could go to jail, it could be him.
Yes, absolutely.
And he can only avoid that by maintaining a political stability that suits him.
Which is going to be difficult unless he ends up with a situation where he is somehow able to influence the NPA, which is looking increasingly difficult.
Hmm. So what has he been doing? You said he's...
He was stumping yesterday and saying that he resigned to avoid in the best interest of the ANC, and he's quite right, because effectively if he had decided to stay and fight, it would have caused a division within the ANC, and I think at that point the country would have been a preferable situation, frankly, from where I'm sitting, because I would have liked nothing better than to see the ANC actually split at that point. Look, hive off all of the various factions into their individual parties, and then let them all sit and fight in Parliament.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
That would be a good idea, because then we'd actually know where people stood. Because, of course, there are a lot of people coming out of the woodwork now saying, oh, I was never a Zuma guy, I had a problem with Jacob Zuma, but they were dead quiet when he was in charge. Now, at the Zondo Commission, they're all happy to come out and say their thing.
Well, the other thing that...
we should look askance at these people.
Yeah, but...
They're hardly the bravest.
It's an interesting one that we have to deal with here. You see, the rules of the ANC are very clear, that you can't actually do anything that's going to undermine the ANC or bring the party into disrepute. In fact, the DA has something very similar. And this is absolutely idiotic, because it means that you penalize whistleblowers within your ranks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what the Zondo Commission has actually done is it's given us an opportunity, because you can't lie under oath.
Yeah.
So you can't be accused.
we think you can't lie under oath.
Well, essentially, what it means is, you, as an ANC member, you're getting a free pass, because you can bring the organization into disrepute, because your defense is, sorry guys, you know, I could not lie under oath.
Yeah.
So that becomes your defense if the ANC tries to go after you. So suddenly there's that opportunity for people to actually step up and make the truth known.
I think we're giving way too much to politicians. They really are, after all, just politicians. And what they're really after is they're after power. They're not after truth or justice of any kind.
Quite right. And the power structure within the ANC up until fairly recently was Jacob Zuma. And let's take Pravin Gordhan as an example.
And very much remains Jacob Zuma.
Well, absolutely. Yes, he's a significant player. We can't in any way write that off. But if you take Pravin Gordhan as an example, had he actually stepped forward and said, here's what's going on, guys, he would have immediately been turfed out of the ANC. Now, it becomes an interesting moral question at that point. Would you be more effective actually playing the long game, and I know that phrase gets overused, staying within the ranks of the ANC until you can get an opportunity to actually come clean? Or should you just be turfed out and then allow someone like Midnight Special to come in and then effectively do pretty much what Zuma wants to do?
That's based on the premise that they want to come clean.
Yes, but, you know, really we should work on... I'm highly cynical, but I'd like to believe that most of us, a friend of mine who used to work in the security industry actually had this very interesting thing. Uh-huh. He said that 10% of people will always be corrupt. 10% of people will never be corrupt. And what you have to do is to try and swing things so that the 80% that are in the middle are incentivized to not go down the path of corruption. And I think this guy had worked in the security industry for years. It's a great business model. If you look in terms of the way in which people behave by and large, I think that's pretty true.
I think fundamentally the politics of South Africa, unfortunately, is skewed by the fact that South Africans are perpetually hopeful. It's the reason why we're in this conundrum as it is. You know, our constitution, fantastic as it is, the best in the world, no doubt about it. However, it is...
Oh, I disagree. I think that the property rights clauses are not strong enough, but let's not go there.
I'll come back to you on those property rights. But the thing about it is, this constitution is one pretty much like where your philosophy seems to be at, one that says we have good people and they will do the right thing. They will, given the chance, they will do the right thing.
It just so happens those people are not in the ANC by and
large. It was written for a Nelson Mandela, and not all politicians are a Nelson Mandela. When you now have a Jacob Zuma, you have a constitution that protects this guy, and wow, guys, 10 years later, we are like, whoa.
Well, when I say that majority of us are actually good people, I don't mean that we are just sitting back on our asses and saying we're going to wait for change to come. You know, blessed are the meek, turn the other cheek. No, actually...
Yes, that would be Zimbabwe.
Oh, my goodness.
But good morning, Kenton.
But think about it, guys. I mean, how many of us that you know of are constantly fighting and railing against the stuff that goes on?
I think probably just threw a whole country under the bus.
Yeah.
All right. I do want to move on because we don't want to get into the philosophy as much as we want the current affairs this morning, because there's enough to talk about there without getting our hands dirty. So the EFF and Pravin. I mean, here's Pravin who, would you say Pravin is in that 10% of people who could not be corrupted, or do you think he's somewhere in the middle? Because the EFF is saying he's in the 10% who are definitely corrupt.
This is an interesting one. I've known Pravin now for about 37 years. Mm-hmm. And we're talking back in the 80s when...
When he was a solid communist.
No, he wasn't a solid communist back then. He was definitely very solid.
Trade union man.
Very solid. No, actually, at that time, he was a pharmacy student at...
you have known him a lot.
At the University of Durban Westville. Well, I was a student at the University of Durban Westville, and I got expelled in 1980 for purported political activism, actually.
Purported. But, you know,
yeah. Well, yeah,
but UDF can
UDF didn't exist at that time. You remember, UDF was only founded in 1985. You know, but Pravin at the time was incredibly smart guy, and I learned a lot from him. The guy used to give me access to material that was not otherwise available legally within the country. So I would never have found out anything in terms of the politics of Latin America, for example, if not for access to books that Pravin Gordhan actually lent me at the time. So,
wow.
You know, the toppling of Salvador Allende and the stuff that brought Pinochet into power, the gerrymandering that happened in terms of Nicaragua, and then the mining of the harbors of Managua, and all of that stuff, and of course access to ANC material, you know, magazines like Sachaba and Dawn, and because the only access that we had to what the ANC was up to at that time was things that were coming from Radio Freedom, which was shortwave broadcast coming out of Lusaka. But essentially what I'm trying to say is I've known the guy for 37 years, and during that time, look, we've had major clashes in terms of differences of ideas and so forth. But this guy does not have a corrupt bone in his body. Trust me, he's had opportunities enough over the period to be seriously filthy rich.
Anyway, I mean, the EFF are alleging that his daughter is, and that he's got an offshore bank account, and all kinds of things.
Well, the offshore bank account stuff is, you know, the Africa Check guys very quickly disabused us of any possibility that there was any truth whatsoever in what Julius was saying.
So, in other words, the question then is, what is their motivation? Because they seem very desperate to me. I've been saying this for the last 2 weeks, because the EFF are behaving like people who've been backed into a corner. I think the VBS scandal has made them all look as corrupt as they probably are. Julius has been directly implicated in a recent expose by Poli van Wyk, which seems to me to be pretty watertight, although that's still up for a little bit of interpretation, and certainly there aren't any criminal charges yet. For various public prosecution reasons. Are the EFF just doing what they do in situations like this, and A, trying to distract us from their own foibles, B, trying to stop Pravin before he does what he might be doing against them that they know about already? In other words, the best defense is an offense. Or is there something else going on that I'm not sure about?
I think Julius has actually become a victim of his own propaganda. I think he's completely forgotten about the fact that the world doesn't really respond to everything that he says, and he's punch drunk on presumed power, which he actually doesn't have. But can we just talk about Poli van Wyk's thing?
Yes,
there's an interesting war that's kind of going on between all of the EFF bots and Poli van Wyk around this supposed bank statement, and of course it's an interesting standoff. Everyone is saying to the EFF, well, if you think that she's lying, then go to court and charge her, and they're saying, no, we actually not going to waste our time on this, which is not true, because you know the EFF will legislate at the drop of a hat. So what's actually going on here? Now, my take on this is pretty straightforward, and it's an old journalist thing that if you have access to information, but you've actually obtained that from an insider, and the only way you can reveal that information is by exposing the insider, then you're not going to do that. So I've no doubt that Poli van Wyk's information is accurate, but she obviously can't come forward with the information without actually blowing the whistle. But at the same time, the EFF cannot actually challenge her in court, because if they challenge her in court, then the information actually has to be presented before court,
which will
then prove that Poli van Wyk is in fact right. So the only defense that the EFF has right now is to actually fight in the court of public opinion, which, as you know, is incredibly fickle.
So what happens next? I mean, are we in a stalemate then?
Well, we're in a stalemate until such time as an appropriate judicial authority actually... And frankly, this starts with SARS, because it's the quickest way to actually get this sorted out. If you actually have a commissioner at SARS who is doing his or her job, that commissioner is going to turn around and say, I actually want to have a quick look at these bank accounts. And yes, there's a prima facie case here that, in fact, there is corruption. So, guys, we holding you accountable. Now, can we actually do an audit? And that's where it starts. So, you know, obviously the elimination of Moyane was the first part of this process. We now need to be in a situation where you have a new commissioner who comes in and who actually starts getting onto that particular bandwagon and saying we're going to hold all of these guys to account.
And who's winning in the court of public opinion at the moment?
Oh,
because you can't believe Twitter. I mean, Twitter's a terrible barometer.
I think, frankly, most people outside in the streets think, well, all of these guys are corrupt, and they're correct. So who's actually winning? I think there's...
Someone said to me, Floyd has... Again, this is my own contribution of hearsay this morning. One of our listeners yesterday said, how does Floyd have four Range Rover Velars in his entourage? Four.
Well, are they his?
Right, who knows?
Yes, well...
More importantly, how does the EFF, like, afford that big promobile that they brought to the Diesel Black Star? You know? I mean, these
weren't they... They were about to be evicted from their offices not so long ago because they'd run out of money.
Well, but have they actually paid the... who sued them recently?
AfriForum.
AfriForum sued them.
Twice.
And don't they owe AfriForum some...
couple of hundred thousand.
Yeah.
I think Julius, in his personal capacity, they were going to attach his Breitling watch and some other things. I mean, it's all very embarrassing. But here's the thing, right? You're asking about the EFF, Pumi, and this is important. I suspect, if you read between the lines, the reason they're going for Pravin in particular is because he did have that supposed rogue unit, which was, you know, SARS's whole investigative capacity, basically. And I think he knows where they get their money. And they know that he's coming for them eventually.
Except he doesn't have the capacity to come for them right now, where he's currently sitting.
But he might be able to give whoever comes in as NPA boss that information. So they need to strike
now. Which I'm pretty certain that he will.
Of course he will. He seems very voluntary, a very volunteering of information at the moment.
So a friend of mine who used to work for the World Bank told me a very fascinating thing about how they worked over there and how his big boss used to always say to him that, you know, it's not always about ending the corruption. It's just about finding a way to live through it. And he worked in circumstances where they worked in war-torn countries in Africa, and they would have to try and get to villages that are behind the barricades of where the rebels are. And so in that moment, and this is the thing, is between what's right and what's important and talking around the moral code of stuff, is sometimes you're
contradicting yourself from what we were talking about earlier, where I was saying people want to do the right thing.
No, but this is why I believe politicians are politicians. Politicians will always do what serves them to keep their power. So even as I see all of the machinations of the EFF, we'll come to that. even kind of when I see what Pravin and the EFF and all of those guys and what their chessboards look like, it's all about power. So it's about their power bases. It's about consolidating their power. It's about how the next move affects the level of power they have to do what they need to do.
Well,
so we should all just slit our wrists and let's go home.
More importantly, and this is about...
Guys, please do not slit your wrists. This is not a call to action.
What we need to do is... even as private citizens, is we need to hold our politicians more accountable. We need to be more participative. We need to. We can't just sit back and just watch the Zondo Commission.
But how do we do that?
Tweet about it.
As ordinary citizens, the only time we really get to participate is once every 5 years when we go to the polls. Because, you know,
and
apart
that
from
is
that,
important.
Yes. So we go to the polls, and we. I like the idea of actually having a choice on the ballot that says none of the above.
That is not the only time we get to participate. We get to participate in your own community, in your own municipality, in your own province. You have to find a way that will change the things that you need to change. So if we just sit back and think that what happens in parliament is the only way that the shit is rolling down to us.
If you try changing things in the municipalities in rural KZN, you get shot.
Yeah, that's true. That's just happened to somebody.
People, that happens all the time.
You were just talking about how you were conscientized in the 80s,
yes.
Right? At a time when people were being shot simply for having the wrong book. the correct. Wrong book. Absolutely. People were being shot.
Absolutely.
So, and here's the thing for me, right, is if we're going to sit here and say, I can't do anything about it, I think there is absolutely something that you can do. You can do it in your community. You can do it in your little complex here in Joburg. You can do,
you can do it in your Stokveld.
You can do it in your... There really is
an opportunity. Except the difference is right now. Remember that back in the 80s, we were fighting an immoral, unjust system, and the stuff that we were doing was illegal. Now, currently we have a democracy. Now we can either
participate in the democracy.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we do, and unfortunately it limits us to every 5 years. Now, if we are going to be doing the type of stuff that we were doing back in the 80s, it means that we're actually seeking to undermine the state, topple the government, and that becomes treasonous. And then all sorts of...
You don't have to do it in the same way that it was done in the 80s, but you have got to hold your government accountable. You have got to participate.
And we do, every 5 years.
No, not just every 5 years. The problem is that we only participate every 5 years. We should be participating...
I'm loving this, by the way.
...every single day.
Okay, so what did you do today?
Kevin! Kevin, I've been awake very long, my brother.
What did you do today?
All right. How can we? I mean, the media's got a role in this.
No, not really. I mean,
you don't think so?
No, I mean the media as such. No, nobody really cares about the media anymore.
You think? Well, this is actually he makes a good point. There was a trust survey that was done not so long ago. So about 11% of the population believes them.
Yes.
Just a little more, somewhere around 25% of the population. And I'll find this survey and give you the exact details of it, so it's not just me making it up. They say about 20-25%, as I recall, believe the media, which is only a quarter at best. And trust in NGOs is at 50%. Trust in business is at 53%.
Yeah, it pays people's salaries.
Right, but people also believe that they understand the motives of business. It's fairly simple.
Yes, we want to make money. Mm-hmm.
Profit
absolutely.
And loss, yeah, that kind of thing. And by the way, we'll be talking to none other than Bonang Mohale later on. He's the CEO of Business Leadership South Africa a little bit later on this matter, because, funnily enough, there is still some trust left in the system. It happens to be in private enterprise and in business generally. And I'm not surprised by that, because people know if... they're promised a salary, they usually get it.
And also,
whereas
business,
government,
business,
if you promised a house, you sometimes get it, you sometimes don't.
But business also generally holds its own accountable, because you do see that within business, when people are shown to be corrupt or they fall from favor, they're very quickly ousted.
As we wait for McKinsey to pay us back the money.
Or for Marcus Juster to find himself in a jail cell, but it'll happen.
It will happen, yes.
You don't think so? You don't think he'll go to jail?
But going back to this thing about the media actually not really mattering in the grand scheme of things.
All right.
Do any of you actually, when last did any of you pick up a newspaper?
No.
Okay. The only time I read newspapers is when I'm on the plane. And they pass it to me because I'm not allowed to put my device on. And so I pick up a newspaper and I read it. It's the only time that I pick up a newspaper. The only time you'll see me tweeting stuff about what's in business day
although
is if I'm
media
sitting
is no
you pick it up. You do pick up the newspaper sometimes to clean up the mess that a pet has made.
Although media is no longer just a newspaper. So a journalist like a Ferreira or a Reedy Tlhabi we saw currently holding momentum, very accountable, very, very vocally. Those are media.
Except that was not that was not on the basis of journalism. That was on the basis of basically bludgeoning momentum into submission. And I was part of that mob in terms of bludgeoning momentum into submission. But it's not journalism.
But
my point
that
is all
that
about
media,
influences.
My point being that the influence of media is no longer just controlled by a particular tabloid or a particular
publication,
but the individuals. The individuals that make up that New York Times, the individuals that make up that Sunday Times, on their own accord, in their own merits, have all of those people that would have read. The reason people are no longer reading the Sunday Times is because I can just tap into the thoughts of those journalists.
But the question is whether you are tapping into the thoughts or whether you are tapping into their journalism, which is a very different thing.
I do agree.
Which is why it is problematic, some of the things that they are tweeting and how they are tweeting it, because they have already got didn't we have this when we were in Germany about the fact that we've got the validation because they are Fariel, who was the editor in chief of the City
they've
Press.
Got, they've got like
she's got a little bit of credibility that we that we believe that those thoughts of hers are informed by knowledge, are informed by research, are fact checked. They're not. They are not always. We assume that, and that's what people that's what swings public opinion is what they are tweeting and how they are tweeting.
No, I think it swings their particular silos. I don't think it swings public opinion at large. Really, I mean, if you let me give you a very practical example. My wife pointed out to me last night that Aki Anastasio on 702 has something like a quarter of a million followers. And the guy is look, Aki's a great guy, but most of the time he's spending the day dispensing traffic information. You know, does that mean that he has a massive sphere of influence? If he suddenly turned around and said that,
I have
example,
information about VBS.
Although, no, he has a massive sphere of influence in how you choose to drive, depending on what it is that he's tweeting.
Yes.
So if he says there's a problem on William Nicol, you're probably not going to take William Nicol. You know, you're going to check your ways, but you're probably not going to take William Nicol. If Fariel, on the other side, says, as she was having a Twitter war with Jimmy Manye last night, right?
Are we allowed to call him Jimmy now?
Aye, guys, listen here. I'm living my best life. Eh? This is what it is. I'm living my best life. Jimmy Manye, what's that?
Mzwanele.
Yeah, I have to think about that. You know, rebranding sometimes is not always
the reprobate, formerly known as Jimmy.
he had a better reputation when he was Jimmy.
But they get into a Twitter war, and all of the thousands of people following those two people are caught in a particular public opinion. That means something. So whether you believe Fariel or you believe that she is stratcom or
whatever.
But
what if we're just there for the entertainment, which is why I'm there.
That's
you
okay.
Know? I kind of pull off my chair and say, I'm going to watch this. This is going to be so much fun.
That's okay. But the thing about ideas, but here's the thing. The thing about ideas is even when said in jest, when you walk away from them and rethink them, you may not know where you got that idea from. But suddenly, the way that you feel, the way that you think about somebody, that is why we call them influencers, because they influence.
You can't manipulate people that way. I mean, I'll prove it to you. Don't think of a pink elephant.
Yeah.
Don't think of a pink elephant.
You're thinking of a pink elephant. You are. It's true. I think it's true, right? Makes a lot of sense. So I don't want to stop you on
the media
bent. Yeah, because you were going to make a point about how they're not that influential. So who do we look to, and how do ordinary people receive their information, and how do they verify sources, and how do we know if something's fake news? And you have to do quite a lot of work, and that's why when I started this discussion with you this morning, I said you come in here, you help us out. Sometimes we'll borrow piecemeal from your opinions in order to give us some kind of standpoint on a thing that we might not have done any research, spent any time thinking about, right?
I think by and large people tend to actually not give a shit about what happens in the world.
Yeah, mostly you're right.
Yeah, I mean, and we're talking about...
And it's quite liberating.
Yes, it is. You know, people get up, they go to work, and, you know, if
you
stuff happens on the way, then they'll say, oh my goodness, and then they'll snap a picture of it, and they'll potentially post it on Instagram. But otherwise, they don't really care. You know, they have to worry about getting the kids out of bed in the morning, making sure that they have their breakfast, dropping them off at school, getting themselves to work, fighting through the traffic. In between, they're listening to music on the radio. Guys, let's be very clear that the music stations...
But until all of those big decisions that we're not paying attention to begin to affect us in our pocket, our everyday life. So even in South Africa's trajectory of politics, if you see when the biggest kind of flare-up, so 1976, right? In 1975, a big kind of economic crunch. So in 76, of course, there's a big... Because people, the anger of people and the way people push. In the 80s, a very long economic crunch here in South Africa. And so the anger of people spills out into the streets. And again, Jacob Zuma, right? We weathered the 2008 big global storm. But as the crunch of economics gets more and more grinding on the people, the push, then the outward push of we're going to push against the system happens. That's what we see.
It's interesting you bring this up because Bonang Mohale, who's going to join us just now, said something similar when I heard him speak at an awards dinner not so long ago about how we'll all look back on this time last year, that ANC elective conference, as having been such a pivotal moment in South Africa's history. And of course, you know, with the benefit of hindsight,
everything makes sense.
Absolutely. But 10 years from now, we may see how much more relevant that moment was than we potentially see it now. And we talk about Pravin, and we talk about Tom Moyane, and we talk about the EFF, and all of these factors that we're in, we're living history at the moment. We still aren't far enough away from it to be able to look at it with a feeling of objectivity, with an ability to judge, well, okay, that was pivotal, this is important. Because there's so much, as you said, Pumi, at the beginning of the show this morning, there's so much going on that a lot of people are just fatigued by this huge stream, this never-ending stream of information. You can listen to radio, watch television, go onto Twitter, go onto Instagram, go onto the news sites. Everywhere you go, you're bombarded with all this stuff. And sometimes, as Canton has pointed out, it's nice to actually just not give a shit. It's very liberating. You start your day, you worry about your things until it starts to affect you.
Mm. Yes.
And there's a lag.
And do you think right now people are feeling it more than they did at this time last year? I don't think so. Even though we're getting information that, you know, it's the third negative quarter in the business confidence surveys and all the rest of it, I think people are feeling a little more optimistic now, and that could be dangerous.
Well, it's dangerous up until the time that we get to the next elections.
Well, don't worry. The politicians will ratchet us up all into hysteria before then. Don't you worry.
Look, and the thing about elections, which for a long time South Africa didn't have, is they're a valve. They're like a pressure valve. You know, you open it up. So you talk about the fact that people, Canton says, every 5 years you get to do something about it. The things that irritate you, every 5 years you get to participate. And the psychological effect of
Or
not participate.
Because there are 7 million registered voters that didn't go to the polls last time.
And that is the problem with democracy. So even today, when they do the surveys of saying, how many people, who are you going to vote for? A lot of people are going, I don't know if I'm going to go and vote. So optimistically, a lot of people are thinking that by not going to vote, the ANC is going to be diminished or whatever, or other people will be strengthened. But what they don't understand, obviously, about the way democracy works is if 100 people vote, because everybody else doesn't vote. If 100 people vote and 60 of those people vote for the ANC, or 66 of those people vote for the ANC, the ANC remains the two-thirds majority. And these are the things that...
And here, as if to make it even harder for us, what we saw with so many of these polls that never predicted Trump and all of these things, the polling is
useless. I predicted Trump at my time.
You did. I did as well. I won some money off of somebody as a result, but I've got that as proof. But very, very few people did. And most of the pollsters and the pundits and those kind of people said, oh, no.
Trump can never win.
It's going to be a dead cert, the walk, you know, shoe in for Hillary. Brexit wasn't predicted. And then all these people lose their minds afterwards because they go, oh, we got it wrong.
Actually, because people don't vote. So the people that don't go to vote are the people that then skew the perspective.
Maybe they're like conscientious objectors. Maybe they're people who don't want to participate in a system they don't believe in.
And then look where that gets us. It gets us a Trump and a Brexit.
Would you prefer...
But guys, can we use Brexit as an example?
Sure.
Okay. Record numbers of people turned out for Brexit. Why did they do that? Because it was a binary choice. It was either yes or no. So it wasn't a question of, am I voting for the Conservatives? Am I voting for Labour? Am I voting for all of these other...
A whole collection of ideological and practical things that you might or might not
care about. Yes, and which fundamentally, you know, don't make a rat's ass difference in my life. So, but in the case of Brexit, you had a record turnout. I mean, I think it was something like 70% of the electorate turned out to vote in Brexit. And of course, what that meant was that Theresa May, the idiot, saw that as support for a conservative platform and called an election, and most of the people who pitched up to vote for Brexit just stayed away at the
polls.
Didn't
pitch for
the polls. They didn't care because, no, okay, we've given you a mandate. We want to get the fuck out of
Europe.
Yeah. Now just go and implement it.
And they are ducking and diving and twisting and turning and trying everything possible. There's so much gymnastics of the mind going on at the moment. Who knows whether this Brexit's going to go anywhere?
It's
so
astonishing.
Bloomberg's headline yesterday afternoon, a no-deal Brexit could cause the worst slump since at least World War II, cause the pound to sink and the Bank of England.
Sure.
It's utter rubbish.
Do you think that's hysteria?
It's complete and utter hysteria. And, you know, I checked all of the fact of the matter is that in the build-up to the vote, there was a massive amount of research that went into this from a whole range of serious think tanks around what are the consequences if Brexit actually happens. The London School of Economics had actually a very in-depth study that took sector by sector and showed that overall the impact of Brexit was going to be neutral in terms of the British economy. And they were absolutely right, because what you end up losing as a result of being part of the European Common Market, you make up with the ability to conduct bilateral agreements with individual, which is exactly Trump's model.
Negotiate your own deal with each of the players.
Absolutely, which is the way it should be.
Rather than be part of some washing machine of ideas where you don't know what you're going to get out afterwards. The color could be transferred from one garment to the next. Now, here's what we do have. Someone sent me a very interesting infographic about this Brexit thing. I don't know how we got to Brexit. We were talking about such interesting things. But let's just deal with this since we're on it.
Politics.
The tricky bit starts as the divorce deal goes to lawmakers. So, Parliament now vote. Let's say they agree to a deal. Then there's an orderly exit. If they don't agree to a deal, there's either a chaotic exit or a general election or a second referendum. So these are the possible ways that this could play out.
Yes.
And whichever way it goes, the British people seem hell-bent on making this happen.
And politicians?
Politicians, not so much.
Yes, but everyone tells us that it's Russian bots that have actually forced them to think this way. I mean, come on, guys. Surely you believe The Guardian on this?
No, I think you'd be very careful to. And their sister publication in South Africa has done a number of embarrassing things in the last week or two that really puts them on the bottom shelf of South Africa's weekly newspapers.
But guys, you know where this goes. I mean, we got onto this Brexit thing just, you know, as a reminder that people will actually pitch up if they believe they have skin in the game. So if they believe that their vote is actually going to make a real difference, then they will. But right now, if you have to choose between Cyril and Musi, for example, frankly, I don't see the difference between them at this point. They're pretty much singing from the same hymn sheet, except what Musi is saying, we are less corrupt than the ANC. But, you know, Musi is weak on property rights. Musi is weak on black economic empowerment.
He's even weak on freedom of speech.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, there's no real difference between...
He's weak on keeping a consistent accent.
I like this. This is maybe my best burning platform of the year. I'm having a lot of fun. Listen,
I'm never coming back here when Catherine's here.
No, I love this. Here's the thing, right? If I could arrange a really interesting lunch party, and December's the right time to be doing this, and I said, guys, there's no time limit, the bill's on me, open up. This is what we would get.
Drinking and talking shit. We're not even drinking, Canton.
We should be.
No, I'm sleep deprived, guys. And, you know, my brain goes kind of haywire, you know.
And I think it's been
working. Yeah, the absence of oxygen in your brain. Yeah, very similar to what alcohol does.
And look, so you guys are making my point for me. The thing about not participating on any level is that you end up with pathetic wet rags, right? My grandmother used to call is dwetwe, a wet rag.
Now, why are you not running for parliament?
Aren't you running for parliament?
I'm way too emotional.
Can I ask you
but
something
this
else?
This is the thing.
Hold
but
on.
This is the
Have
thing.
You met Lindiwe Zulu?
For me, would you prefer a world where we force people to participate? Like in Australia, for example, you have to vote.
Mm-hmm.
There are penalties involved if you don't vote. Would you prefer a system like that? Do you think we'd get a much more involved and representative and engaged democracy if we did
that? No, I think people need to participate where they feel that they can participate and make a difference. There are,
but we can't
so
even choose our ward councillors.
There are so many ways.
We don't
to
even
do
know
that.
Who our ward councillors are because the party list system imposes them on us.
All I'm saying is that there are so many ways to participate. You don't have to participate simply by being in politics the way that classic politics works. You can participate in business. You can participate in NGOs. You can participate. There are many ways to participate, but not participating is exactly what gets us to a point where what you have to choose from is Julius, Musi, and Cyril.
That is an that's a terrible menu.
Magwaza Msibi.
Magwaza Msibi. Have you voted for her? Is that why you brought her up?
I'm just putting it out there to say, you know, guys, if we're talking about, and Kanthan, earlier you spoke about how if all the various factions were to stand independently of each other, it would give us more of an opportunity to have lots more fighting in parliament, right? The thing about if there are two ways, you either don't vote at all or you vote for strengthening some kind of opposition that you believe in, whatever that is, you know, whether that is, how many years has your friend and mine now been the UDM's president?
Since the beginning of time. Since Genesis chapter 1, I think.
With no succession plan in place.
In Nelson Mandela Bay, yes.
With no succession plan in place. Just like Umtuana.
It's Bantu's personality cult. That's what it is.
But I think then, you know, find the opposition that you feel needs to be strengthened, whether it's Zanele Magwaza Msibi, guys.
I like how you keep bringing her up. We'd all forgotten she existed. I thought she was an ANC idea to keep KZN
busy. But what is Shenge up to these days, anyway?
I saw him three Mondays ago. And, you know,
I saw that on your...
He's 90 years old, Shenge. He's an old man now.
Yes.
And he was talking, and he's still very lucid. Don't get me wrong. Age is no barrier here. He commands a lot of respect. He's got a very, very interesting past, and a lot of people criticize him for valid reasons, you know, at various points in history. But the guy has a presence about him. He's got a dignity about him. He seems to understand for the longest time.
I've got to tell
you,
we used to be scared shitless of him
in the
80s.
He has face-to-face with Verwoerd. I mean, that's quite a history. He met with him, I think he was 27, when he met face-to-face with Verwoerd and told him what he thought of him and told him what Zulu people needed and wanted. Back in those days, can you imagine how much confidence you have to do that? And we're going to get him in and talk to him soon. So I'll ask him whatever you want me to ask him. Put it on the table now and let's go. But I don't know that he's a political force to be reckoned with like he once was.
Actually, if you look in terms of the track record of by-elections over the past period, Inkatha has been steadily taking away seats from the ANC. Very steadily. Go and check out the...
And from Magwaza Msibi.
Yeah, of course. Very much so.
All right, so maybe he is worth checking in.
Well, I think right now, certainly at that level.
I mean, he's also been the head of the IFP
so
for
you
the
know, you know, yeah. I mean, I was young when the first elections came out, but just looking at all the slogans, because advertising is something I really love, I loved the fact that the IFP's first slogan going into the first elections, was, of course, because you were voting for Umtuana, was Indoda Ongayithemba. A man you can trust.
Is that what they said?
Like, man.
Wow.
Well, I think you can trust him, but, you know, it's a question of trusting him to do what?
Yeah.
You can trust him to come, look,
to
go
to
after your
butt. To deliver to his constituents.
Absolutely.
So for his constituents, they feel the man delivers. He's delivered what they want
it's
him
like
to deliver.
It's like every forum, right? They deliver to their constituents. And...
Well, Nkandla happens to be an Inkatha constituency.
That's right. They've certainly delivered to certain people in that respect. But they have also achieved some interesting things. I mean, Inkatha Freedom Party has been a very important player in trying to get marijuana legalized. You know, there was Ambrosini before he died, who was an Inkatha MP. And there are a number of other things.
And he was a smart guy.
I saw just last night a COPE MP is one of the front runners and one of the most important players in bringing in legislation which will allow LGBTQ people to...
LGBTQI.
Yeah, all right, but eventually the whole... you know what I mean.
Okay. Sorry. Right.
LGBTQI, and there's a plus, and there's a R, and there's a whole lot more. But the
legislation?
Point is... Yes, there's a woman from the from COPE.
Is she a woman? Are you assuming her gender?
She said she's
a
woman.
Stop it.
From COPE.
It doesn't matter.
Who said that she wants... And they've managed to get this promulgated. I think it's possibly even already been passed as legislation. But Home Affairs cannot deny you a marriage on the basis of cultural or religious nonsense if you decide you want to marry someone. And this is progressive.
As opposed to having a civil certificate type thing. Yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
But I mean, who have Home Affairs to get in your way, frankly?
Yes.
You know, if two consenting adults want to do something, Home Affairs shouldn't be the obstacle to their doing something, as long as it's legal.
And you see, the thing about all of the theatrics of Parliament and the EFF and, you know, the Gordons and the cases and all of that.
I'm feeling a bit intimidated because you're standing up at this point.
Bona, I've had enough of sitting down. Now I'm
she
on my
feet. You should go to Parliament.
Mama.
I think you're right.
I think so.
Catherine's right. No, you should be.
But the thing about those theatrics, and if you do participate and find, you must find a way, Baba, of getting your policies across.
I want you to go to Parliament with the slogan, "A woman you can trust." All right. And on that note, that is the burning platform for this morning. God, what an awesome hour. Jesus.
A mother you can trust.
Yeah, a mother. Yeah, exactly.
She got half the word.
Thank you, Pumelele. Thank you, Canton Pile.
Pleasure, guys.
What a pleasure to have you both here. The Burning Platform, as always, brought to you by Nando's. I'm expecting record downloads on this podcast. This is quite something. Holy hell. CliffCentral.com